Welcome to the Scottish Watches podcast. We have a returning guest. How many times is this?
I think this could be the fourth time, maybe.
And you are the fourth what?
Fourth managing director.
And this is some kind of celebratory appearance because of another number, 175.
175, Project 175, 175th anniversary, yes.
Yeah, and we have watches to speak about, an anniversary to speak about, a party to speak about, and a book.
It's going to be a lot of celebration today.
It's going to be a big episode. If you don't recognise that voice, that is number four, Nicholas Bowman-Scargill from the Fears Watch Company. And joining us on the sofa today, we have...
Good morning. It is David. You know I'm not going to help myself.
Yeah, but yeah.
You can only hope.
Well, we are here to celebrate a lot of different things, and I really don't know where to start. So we're going to start with a bit of tradition and do a wrist check. And you are here in Scotland, so we will offer you the floor. Go for it, Nick. What have you got?
Thank you. So today I'm wearing my own personal Fears Brunswick White. It was actually the first Brunswick we made. I bought it from the company, paid full price for it. And it's the watch I wear almost every single day. I've got it on a brown alligator strap. It's my sort of daily beater, as the scratches and dings on it will show.
And what year did that one come out?
This one came out in 2017, which you blink and you suddenly realize is 4 years ago.
It does seem like a long time, doesn't it? It only feels like yesterday when that watch was announced.
Yeah, it does. But yeah, it's 4 years ago, and so much has happened and changed since then.
It certainly has. I mean, I was looking through a gifted book that you brought with you. Thank you very much for that. And even just skimming through the pages there, I've already picked up bits and pieces that we can talk about as we go on. David, what have you got on?
David.
Nicholas, isn't it?
Oh, okay.
Nick and Dave.
The Nick and Dave show. Or the Nicholas and Dave. I'm thinking, what am I going to call you?
Well, it's not the weekend, so Ricky will do fine.
So I am wearing my Louis Erard Alain Silberstein collab piece from the original one, which has its rather bright strap that's been done by the strap tailor for me, as the original strap wasn't really my thing. So that's what I have been wearing today.
And you've been getting quite a lot of different new straps, haven't you?
I have.
You have?
That sounded like a loaded question. There was no cheeky retort like I'm firing through, so I'll let that one settle.
In the last episode, you spent a good 20 minutes talking about buying a strap or not buying a strap, getting a quote for a strap. So how much was this one?
If I remember rightly, maybe about just shy of 200, I think it was, we get done, which was, it was based on one that he does, but with some kind of changes to the keepers and the colours and such like on it. So, and done to the sizes to fit this watch. So yeah, and a custom length so that it was just a kind of appropriate tail on the strap, because the original was also quite a long strap, which my little weedy wrists wasn't ideal. So yep.
Very nice.
I have technically, it's on my wrist, but off my wrist, because I took it off because it's squeaking still. So I didn't think you'd be appreciating the squeaky noises during the editing.
No.
The hamster has to go back in its cage at some point.
And the gerbil. Yes.
So, I'll just call you Ricky because it's not the weekend, you know. What may or may not you have on your wrist?
I'm wearing a British watch today. So I am wearing the Elliott Brown Holton, which is very nice. I've had it for about 4 or 5 months now. Got it before we did the interview with the guys at Elliott Brown. They sent it up for me to check out, and they've not asked for it back, so don't tell anybody. And I thought, because obviously Fears is part of the Alliance, Nick is part of the Alliance, and these guys are as well, that I would wear this one here, because this is one of the very few British watches that I have. And as Nick pointed out, it's got the broad arrow on it, it's legit, and it is just a chunky B number. Really like it.
Why is it every time I hear Alliance, all I can think of is that part at the start of Star Wars where Darth Vader says, "You're part of the Rebel Alliance and a traitor, take her away." That's all I think about every time I hear the Alliance. And I've been desperate to say it, so I've said it.
I'm now going to think of that every single time we have a catch up. It's going to be like, part of the Alliance, the Rebel Alliance.
You're a traitor.
We're going to take the Swiss down.
We're going to talk about Alliance as well, because I want to get a bit of a catch up with you, because there was recently the Bellwether report that came out.
Yes,
and Bellwether. You can talk a little bit about that. But where do we start with your stuff? It's been a couple of months. Last time we did speak to you, it was obviously the announcement and release of the Platinum. And that went pretty well for you, you were saying?
Yes, the release of the Platinum, and that came a month after the release of the Brunswick Brown, which was our limited edition five pieces with the anniversary logo on the case back. And so at that point, it kind of felt like by the end of March, we'd already done quite a spectacular year of, you know, new launches. The Platinum has proved very popular. We have, we're finishing two new pieces at the moment for owners, which is wonderful. It's also resulted in some people commissioning watches in solid gold. So we've done a few, we've done two in 18 karat gold, and we're about to start making a short run in 9 karat gold, which is a very sort of traditional English karat weight of yellow gold. So it's been lovely because they're all made in the same way, this, you know, the hand polished, handmade in Canterbury by a jeweler. So yeah, by the time we sort of got into April, I was like, wow, you know, it feels like if we were to say that's our year, I think we'd
be quite happy.
But of course, at the back of my mind, I was like, but I know what's coming in the summer. And I have to say, the last few weeks have been the busiest I have ever worked, but have also just been wonderful. And it's wonderful because, you know, we go back to, you know, March 2020 when the world turned upside down. And my number one thing was got to get Fears to the 175th anniversary. Like, we've got to survive. We've got to do this. And so the fact that we're here now and we're actually, you know, in the process, in the middle of celebrating it. Yeah, this is a very special moment.
Good. Excellent. Well, there's probably loads of stuff we've not even mentioned yet, like the birthday party.
Yes, the party.
So much to talk about. Where will we start? Will we talk about what's come first, right? Obviously, the Platinum came out. What was next? Let's take it chronologically, because we're a watch podcast.
Right, okay. So we'll go going in the correct order. So the first part of the very first part of the celebration were the Brunswick Brown pieces back in February.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next part of the celebration is the release of the book, the publication of the book. Okay.
So the first thing we're going to chat about then is the book. How did this come about? When did the idea form in your head?
Well, I think the book probably started right back in 2015, 2016, before I'd even restarted the company. And I was beginning to research and finding bits and bobs from the information from our limited archive and going to Bristol and getting information there. And I remember thinking at the time, like, I really wish there was just a book I could go to and it had everything there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we fast forward to 2019, and in April 2019, I hosted the first meetup of the Fears Owners Club. And this was in Bristol, the historic home city of Fears. And suddenly we've got a room filled with 20 Fears owners, a few of which I knew and a lot I didn't know. Some who owned modern Fears watches and a lot who owned watches that, you know, they'd been inherited from their grandparents or their parents. And I got chatting to this lady, Jane. We're sat on this sun-soaked terrace overlooking the harbour, gin and tonic in hand, and she mentions that she's an author. And I go, oh, well, that's interesting, because, you know, in a couple of years, we're going to have the 175th anniversary, and this would be I'd love to publish a book about the history of Fears. And she sort of jokingly goes, well, I could write the book for you, you know. And like all those things that basically start over a drink as a joke. A month later, she texts me and goes, so about that book, do you fancy doing it? And I was like,
Nick, no. See, when you have a drink conversation in someone's kitchen, you don't start a business off the back of it. That's not how this works.
Oh, I am the worst for suddenly going, yeah, why don't we explore this? I know nothing about publishing. I know nothing about books. You know, being dyslexic, I can count on two hands how many books I've ever read in my life. So I was like, how do we do this? She said, well, come back to Bristol. I'll introduce you to a publisher and I'll introduce you to basically the process, how you create a book. She said, when would you want to launch it? And I was like, I don't know, some point in 2021. And she was like, okay, to do that, we would need to be starting like right now. And I'm like, oh, but that's like 2 years away. Yeah, she goes, no. So basically you've got to research it, and the research can be, you know, a year or so. And then we've got to draft up the first manuscript, and that takes X amount of time. It's got to be proof checked. An editor's got to go through it. And then by the time we get to the final manuscript, then you design the book. Mm-hmm. And that could be, you know, 4, 5, 6 months. And then at the very end, it's got to be proof checked again, and then goes off to be actually published. Actually, literally pages printed and cut and bound. And you're suddenly going, right, okay, this is not making a watch. Like, if you said to me, release a new watch, it's not easy, but at the same time, I've now done it several times. So I know the timeline, I know the people that will need to be involved, how to do it, what stages. Book, completely different. And I also realized at that point, I had to make a decision. If we were going to do a book, was it going to be a self-published, you know, we've created it, we've designed it, we've printed it, and then we've put it out there? And I thought, no, you know what? I'm always 110% or 0%. If we're doing the book, it's got to be ISBN numbered, properly published, and you've got to be able to buy it from Amazon. Please don't buy it from Amazon. I lose money on every copy where they sell. But the fact is, a real book is on Amazon. You know, you can go to Waterstones. There is the book, you know. And for me, that was a big thing of going.
Yeah, it's not a vanity exercise. It is actually a proper exercise in doing it as, okay, I'm a watchmaker. I don't write books. Leave that to the people that do books. In the same way as if someone that writes books decided to make a watch, I'd not think it was legitimate. So yeah, it gives it a degree of legitimacy that you wouldn't necessarily get by self-publishing. Not to say that all self-publishing is bad, but it's doing it properly.
This is the thing, you know, if we were self-publishing, we'd still get people to proofread it and all that. But the fact is, when you're working with a publisher, suddenly you're going through this whole extra line of it has to be researched in a different way, written in a different way. So many people read that book before we actually put the words into a design on the computer. Just the Word document, I think we got through 7 or 8 versions of it. Mm-hmm. And so many people read it. And so many people also read it and were checking against sources, checking the raw info. And so for me, it's going, I know that it's correct. Mm-hmm. Like, you know,
you've got layers of bias that are stripped out of it by having, you know, multiple different people who are completely unrelated to fears or you actually investigate it, as opposed to...
But that's good.
I mean, that's how it's done properly though, isn't it? You know, you've got those layers of...
If you've got this intrinsic knowledge in your head, you can skip across certain things.
Yes.
That's why
you've
I like...
You've missed the obvious.
You've missed the obvious. You think you've got common general knowledge in your brain that you've heard that's been said so many times, and you'll skip across it. Whereas somebody that doesn't know anything but watches or whatever, they'll double check that and make sure.
And this is the thing. And Jane used to be, before she was an author, she was a journalist. And so she was used to doing that sort of investigative journalism. And then it meant that, you know, I gave her access to the Fears archive. I gave her access to the information. She's going, okay, this is a really good starting point. It's full of holes. Like, why did this happen? When did this happen? Where are the dates? But she lives in Bristol. And she's good friends with people who work in the Bristol Archives, in the Central Library, at the university. So she was basically going to these people and going, right. Whereas I was going, when I had done research 5 years before, I was going, what do you have for Fears watches? Very little information. She was going, I need to find all the information you have about this person, because I found on an old letterhead that they were a director of Fears. And so I want to look into their, like, you know, and then also... She suddenly was putting in letters into the Bristol Post, basically saying, have you ever heard of Fears Watches? Did you used to work for them? Did you? She managed to find a watchmaker who in the 70s worked for Fears in its final dying days. And this wonderful, slightly crazy gentleman was able to regale her with information that basically we had no other way of getting hold of. And then he also had in his possession a 1975 brochure for Fears. Oh, yeah. And suddenly we're looking at a range of watches that Fears used to make. We found out where their old location was, which I'd never known. And this is the thing. I assumed Fears had closed in the 60s. Turned out, no, it ran right through to 76. But I mean, its final days, it was, you know, it was being wound up, but it ran through to 76. So suddenly my information that I have about this company that I'm lucky to run today, it's just grown. And that's because we did it this way, rather than me just saying, here's my information, turn this into a story.
And I think the interesting thing as well is, you know, luckily I have a lovely copy as well that I'm going to spend the time reading, but unlike so many, let's leave them unnamed companies, there's no bias of a marketing spiel in this. You know, this is just a piece of factual work that gives history that's not been driven by a narrative of a company.
David, you don't mean Rolex written out that other guy that isn't Wilsdorf. You're not talking about that from their history, are you?
I possibly comment, good luck in court. but you know, there's many companies, let's be honest, whose backstory that's put out there isn't, we'll use your phrase, full of holes. You know, this is a piece of, you know, intelligently researched, sympathetically researched information that is a true history, warts and all, so to speak, which is, you know, not many companies, I don't think, would be brave enough to necessarily push that out there, because, you know, every company's got its little foibles in its history and everything else.
That point is so true, because in, you know, in the research, we unearthed that in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, twice Fears almost went bankrupt and was beginning to wind itself up for voluntary liquidation. And Jane's saying to me, she's like, did you know this? I said, no. And she goes, you know, it's not exactly Fears at its shining best. And I was like, but we had an agreement right at the beginning. Like, this is effectively, this is what it is. You know, we put everything in context. Also, when it came to it, you know, she's like, well, what do you want to contribute to the book? And I said, look, I, you know, I'll happily be quoted in the chapter dedicated to myself, you know, yeah. But effectively she interviewed me once for that chapter. The rest of it is her writing, because I said, I didn't want to guide her. I didn't want to interfere. Added to that, the fact that she isn't a watchmaker, she doesn't work in the watch industry, meant that her approach was much more of a looking at this as a family business. And yes, there are certain watches and certain bits, and we've got a lot of information about the watches that Fears made. But also, if you know a bit about watches, this is still an interesting read. This is something, if you're interested in basically the last 175 years of British business history, you're learning about all kinds of things to do, like what happened during the First World War. You know, what was Bristol like during the war and the Blitz? You know,
well, I asked you a question. I said, what's the story here? And you said, if you look closely, the inside of that structure of that building doesn't exist because that could blown to smithereens.
This is it. All the Fears structures all took direct hits. But then there's a lovely anecdote that Jane unearthed from a Fear family member about the third managing director and his wife. So in Bristol during the war, it was considered very unpatriotic to leave the city and go to the country where it was much safer. Bristol being a big industrial city at the time, it was a direct target. Now, what did end up happening was as the war went on and it was getting bombed, people were leaving. And so Amos Reginald Fear, as a sort of, you know, well-respected businessman in the city, was put in charge of sort of running his local part of the Home Guard. And also he was put in charge of looking after people's keys for their houses. So they were leaving their houses in Clifton and evacuating, and he was put in charge of looking after them. And there's a story of one evening when their own house in Clifton took a direct hit from an incendiary bomb, but it didn't go off. But it started, like, it landed in the top floor. And his wife, Evelyn, went up with a bucket of sand and put it out before it burst into flames in their own house. And there's just this wonderful idea of going, how were they doing this? Like, you know, but it brings it to life going, that's what it was like being, you know, a businessman running a family business. You had to deal with things like that in the evening, in the 40s. So
the book really is as much a social history, a documentary of people's lives, of business. You know, the fact that it was watches is almost a side story to the actual history of the people, how it worked and everything else. And the kind of, it brings in the fact that watches is a theme that runs through, as that's what the business was. So yeah, I look forward to reading it and digesting.
So what would you say then would be the standout points that were brought to your attention that you didn't know? What did she uncover?
The number one thing that I was sort of blown away by was learning that the company had run for an extra whole decade. And that was really interesting because it was in that period where, you know, the mechanical watches were beginning to die. You know, we're in the mid-70s, we're in quartz crisis territory.
Right in the midst.
But it turns out it wasn't really quartz crisis. It was more just a lot of family businesses at that time were really struggling. So that was particularly interesting. Another interesting fact was that, so Edwin Fear, who founded it, he learnt watchmaking in actually just outside of Bristol in a little village town called Chew Magna. But both his son and his grandson, they learnt watchmaking out in Glashütte. And we've got in the archive, which was unearthed from a family member, a school escapement. And it's proudly, you know, engraved with Amos R. Fear, Bristol, England. And then on the other side, it's then got like Glashütte and Saxon. And they learned their watchmaking out there because at the time, German watchmaking was considered the absolute pinnacle. That's where you went to learn watchmaking.
So would that be kind of any relation through the whole time when, you know, the German with Lange and also with
Grossmann
were developing watchmaking schools. So it was all very falling into that.
And so, in fact, you look at it. So A. Langenzunna was founded a year before Fears in 1845. And it was in the 1870s that Edwin was starting to send his son over there. So literally within the first sort of couple of decades, two or three decades of of the German, you know, watch industry, but, you know, growing, they realized this is where they had to go and learn. And so they sent watchmakers over there to learn, to then bring back this, you know, superior knowledge. Yeah,
that's why the Jerrys came to bomb your house.
They were like, we sent the excellence back to the school. Let's take it back.
But, you know, there are lots of little things like that, you know, as just a kind of one line, they're like, oh, that's interesting. But when you're reading it in the whole context of the history of the company, you're going, I really get a flavor for what my relatives did before me and how they structured the business and what they were going for. And they weren't just keeping it a tiny little company with one or two watchmakers. I mean, by the 20s, they had 100 watchmakers. You know, we're talking a big company. And
what was their annual rate of watch production back then?
We're looking probably in the hundreds of thousands.
Jesus.
I mean, yeah, we're so talking a huge. Lot of watches. And also to the point that before the end of the 20s, they had expanded and they had outposts of the business in Birmingham and Manchester. So Fears was going to take over. And then, of course, these things happened that the second generation, you go on to the third generation, just as the Wall Street crash happens, just as the Great Depression happens. Also, interestingly, I hadn't realized things like going back on the gold standard in the 20s, which was seen as being a wonderful thing. We're back on the gold standard, was absolutely disastrous for businesses using gold and precious metals.
What is the gold standard for people who don't know, like me?
The gold standard is an idea where your money or your currency is backed by gold. So in the Edwardian period, if you went to the Bank of England and handed over a pound coin, say, they would give you its equivalent in gold, in the heavy metal. And so the idea is that your currency is backed by gold, which means that
that's
your currency...
That's why they hold gold at Fort Knox, right?
Exactly.
Or the Bank of England gold reserves, for example, you know, it was always a promissory note. Money was a promissory note against the value of gold.
Remember some of that when I was getting into cryptocurrency and learning about fiat currencies and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
So we came off it and then we had the war. And then after the war, in I think it was 24, Churchill was the one to get us back onto the gold standard, which was seen as being this is return to the glory days. But actually economically, it was disastrous. You know, it really caused a lot of problems. And all of this is in there. And so you're kind of going through from 1846 to 2021 and you're seeing how things kept changing. And then you're kind of having it in context of this watch company. Now, it is a book about watches. So one of the things where I tried to not interfere too much in its design, because the publishers, they know what they're doing. But I was adamant that we would have the watches from the archive, photographs and information, they would all be on right-hand pages, so that if you pick up the book and all you want to do is look at the watches, you can thumb through the book and find that every few pages, there's a whole page with a watch on it. So, and then each chapter has at the end an archive section showing artifacts. So even the Fears spoons, you think your Rolex spoons are fancy, wait till you see the Fears spoons. So yes, the idea is that if you want to sit down, you know, with a nice cup of tea and basically spend several hours, best part of a day, just reading it from cover to cover, you've got a very in-depth book about the history. Or if you want to just pick it up and flick through it, you've got lots of little bits of information, captions with every image, so you understand what everything is. I kind of wanted it to be, you know, for the watch enthusiasts, but also for, you know,
history buffs.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of, you know, this covers.
And it's a readable book or it's a coffee table book. It's kind of whatever you want it to be.
Because the thing is, you know, I've got a good number of watch books at home and I love flicking through them. But a lot of them are very much reference books of a particular watch. You know, I want a bit more than
hard
just
to digest.
Exactly.
It's very technical heavy. It's like, this is X, this is this spring, this is this bit. It's not actually, there's no narrative, there's no story, there's nothing. There's nothing you particularly remember because you'll only ever go back and look it up. Whereas this, you'll read stories and anecdotes about people and
the
bits and these kind of things.
I picked out, you guys obviously told me to put the book down and start recording because we were running out of time. But I was flicking through this and the bits that I liked on first perusal was seeing the adverts from yesteryear and the pricing, and it would say this has got this, this and this in it, and if you want one with this, this and this in it, it is this price. And looking at the typography, the fonts that were used back in the day, and you've also got your usual stuff where you've taken all the typefaces and logos from previous years, decades and generations and included them in the book. And as you're flicking through it, like you said there, it's not structured like a technical document. It's structured like a walk through history, like H.G. Wells, The Time Machine. You're just basically pressing the button forward and climbing through those decades and centuries. Amazing.
Well, I heard last week from someone who said they'd received their copy, and they said, I sat down to flick through it, and 4 hours later, my wife came and said, are you still reading the book? And he realized that he was like, I sat down to read it and then suddenly found that I'd consumed 150 pages in one sitting. He's like, I don't know where that or how that happened. But I think
that's a great sign though of a well-written book as well. You know, a well-written book is a book that does capture you and time vanishes. That's, you know, there's many a book I've read that I'm interested in, but it's dry and it's, you're like, right, keep going, force yourself, you know, it's almost back to the uni days of, right, I need to do this because someone's going to ask me a question. And I've also just had other books where, as you say, suddenly 4, 5, 6 hours have vanished. Yeah. You know, it's like good book, good television, whatever. If it's well done, I think that is testament to getting someone to do it, like Jane, that actually is skilled in that.
Yeah, I mean, there was a concern of having an author who isn't, I mean, she's a watch person in that she owns a few watches, but she's not, you know, in the industry. And, you know, she herself was saying, I'm a bit concerned because, you know, I'm not a watch, but I don't know it. And I said,
that's the best thing.
But the fact is, you're coming at this with purely, like, you know, objective eyes of, is this an interesting fact? Because if it's interesting to you, it's absolutely going to be interesting to the, you know, to the watch enthusiast, but it's also going to be interested to someone who is interested in Bristol business or history or, you know, so.
Or vintage adverts or, you know, all of these things. And again, a couple of things that's just really come to my mind is it just shows you, doesn't it? You know, history goes back a long way, 175 years at the end of the day. But certain things you think, in this day and age, we think, oh yeah, we travel all over the world easily and people work in Germany or Switzerland or the UK or all of these things. But, you know, that tells you back then they were going to learn their craft in Germany and they would get trained in Germany. You know, this isn't a modern thing. It's something that has happened for a long time that we forget that, you know, the world has been quite a small place for quite a long time now. You know, we still think of that as very modern and it's not as modern as we think it is.
There's also, you realise very quickly how a lot of watch companies, you could see that back then that the industry, you know, not just in Britain, but, you know, across Europe spoke to each other because suddenly in the 1890s, you've got certain members of the Fear family going across to the US to explore the new world and like see should they be setting up shop over there? Should they be, you know, doing that? And I was looking at the dates and it's around almost the same time that a certain Mr. Patek is traveling over there and, you know, getting the first contract signed with Tiffany and basically going and discover. And you realize that actually, just as with getting members of the family, you know, trained in watchmaking in Glashütte, like you realize that these watch companies, they weren't just working in little silos. Though the world was very localized, you know, Bristol was very different from London, you know, for a long time, they had different times, you know, and to this day, they have clocks which will show Bristol time and London time. But in the same time, there were clearly trends in the industry. You know, we think of the big trends like the move from pocket watch to wristwatch and then shaped watches to round watches. But actually just running a watch business, there were, you know, there were certain things that they were
even,
all doing.
And even marketing, you know, we think now modern marketing and everything's super sophisticated. But, you know, as you mentioned in some of the old adverts, you know, for you can have this and this option for this price. And if you want these options, it's this price. You still see that, you know, that's still the basic tenure of marketing and everything. It's a, you can buy this for this price, but for a little bit more, you can have this. You know,
well, we can talk about that later on.
Indeed, we can indeed.
Now, we obviously have a lot to get through and we've covered the book there. So as we finish up on the book, it's available now. How much does it cost? Where's the best place to get it? Have you got enough stock to furnish all the people that are listening just now that are wanting to grab a copy of this? Maybe for themselves, a gift, Christmas gift idea, who knows? Everyone's got Ryan's book. That's old hat. That
Ryan's
is.
Book, comfy chairs are last
comfy
year's
chairs. I'm sitting in a very stiff stool. So details on the book then.
So the book titled Elegantly Understated, 175 Years Fears Watch Company. It's £60. It comes with free shipping if you buy it from the Fears website, and it also comes wrapped up in some very beautiful heritage logo wrapping paper.
Mm-hmm.
It's also available from Amazon and from Waterstones. So if you want to just do a nice, quick, easy click, you can purchase it from them. I'm pretty certain we'll have enough copies. It's funny, when we did our first print run is 500 copies. And at the time, you're like, how are we ever going to sell 500 books? And then already it's been out for about a week and a half. And suddenly you're going, yeah, no, we're okay. We've still got them. But, you know, there will probably they're selling well. There will be a second print run at some point.
No, that sounds fantastic. And I was at the start going to ask about if you would do an audio version. But as I thumbed through it, I thought it's so picture heavy that it would be just a waste of time. That's what this podcast is for. You can just listen to Nick.
Maybe we can get our ASMR.
I was going to say, we'll get Nick on at Christmas time and he can read a couple of chapters.
You can have that wee subliminal, buy a book, buy a book.
No, that's reversed. That's in the theme tune at the end, reversed.
I've got this vision. You're going to set up a camera. I'm going to be sat in front of a TV with a log fire. It's going to be like, right, now we're going to sit down for the book reading.
Correct. That's exactly how we do it. Bingo.
Sounds like a plan.
Perfect. Well, that leads on to talking a little bit about the 175 birthday and what you are doing to celebrate it. So what is next is
we are in, I think, about a week's time from when this is being recorded, we're going to have the official celebration. And it seems to the outside world that it is an incredibly OTT, somewhat decadent party. But as I keep reminding people, this is a one-off. We are celebrating the 175th anniversary. The next anniversary will be the 200th anniversary in 2046. So this is the time to celebrate. Next year, there won't be another celebration. And
just for reference, I'll not be here for that.
I doubt I will be, to be honest.
And after the last year, celebrate as much as you can.
Absolutely.
Well, and this actually kind of leads into it. So I'd been thinking about what were we going to do for the party? And I thought I wanted to do something which was going to be a really big celebration. And it's a celebration, but also it's a thank you to people who have supported Fears over the last 5 years since the relaunch, you know, whether it's, you know, people allowing me to come on their podcast, whether it's people purchasing some of those very first watches, or it's just people who have always been incredibly encouraging and supportive in the comments section on posts. You know, it's a broad range of people, but for one night, Fears is taking over the top three floors of the Shard in London. So yes, and I'm a big fan of architecture, and I remember living down the road from where the Shard is now when it was being built. So I remember seeing it going up as a concrete pillar and then the glass going on. But the fact that, you know, since it was built in 2007, 2009, it's still the tallest building in Western Europe next year.
Yep.
Next year, there's a new building in Paris that overtakes it. And I just thought, you know what? An anniversary like this, 175 years, we've got to go somewhere that's just unique. It's spectacular. And people have done events in the Shard, but usually on floor 20, 30, where the restaurants are. I thought, no, we're going to the top. And so this is where things, in a sort of horrible way, all collide together. Because of the pandemic, the Shard has closed 2 days a week at the moment, rather than being open 5 days a week. And that suddenly allowed us the opportunity that if we wanted to rent it on one of those closed days, it's a fraction of the cost of renting it normally.
Yeah.
So suddenly it went from being completely unreasonable and unobtainable to being, it's a stretch, but we can do this. And so I thought, we've just got to do this. And so we have three floors, floor 68, 69, 72, 72 being the roof. So it's open air. And yeah, for the night, we've got live music, catering, a little speech from myself. We'll be putting this out live on the Fears Instagram as well for people who, because yeah, we wanted to invite a lot of people from around the world. And as you can imagine, also, we can't run the event at full capacity. So, you know, we are limited. We can't invite absolutely everyone we want to have there. But yeah, we get to, for one night, do that. The fact that I loved when I was being shown around the building before we signed the contract was that when you're on the top floor, you are 300 meters above street level. And of course, the guy told me this and he said it, and I was like, oh, wow, that's impressive. And I was like, stopped and thought, that's really impressive. And he kind of looked at me and I said, this may not mean anything to you, but 300 meters is the sort of standard depth that a dive watch goes to. And we're the exact same amount above street level. And he sort of just looked at me like, he's not a watch person. But I love that fact that basically we are as high up as your Submariner will go down.
So if there's a flood, you're pretty much okay.
Pretty much okay.
Good. We're willing to test some watches for diving on the moon, you know, for all those conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
But you suddenly realize when you're at the top of a very, very tall building, the tallest building of everything around you, that we were talking about August, summer evening, sun setting, and you suddenly go, oh, there's nothing that's going to cast a shadow on this building. There's no other building.
Good for photos.
Exactly. So, yeah, we're telling everyone who's coming on the night to bring their sunglasses because, yeah.
I mean, to be fair, you know, by British weather, it's probably going to be above the weather.
Well, with the August summer we're having at the moment, yeah. You know, we could have snow. So, like, you know, we'll see what happens.
I'll arrange
night.
To bring that with me, don't worry.
Yeah.
So who have you got coming along? Is there any sort of industry veterans, friends, maybe guys from the Alliance, Make France, etc.?
So we've got quite a few CEOs and founders of British watch companies. As you can imagine, being the middle of the summer, a lot of people have managed to escape away to go on holiday. But we have got a wonderful guest list. I think it's going to be, I think people on the night will be sort of pleasantly surprised with who they're bumping into and rubbing shoulders with. Yeah. So yeah, it's going to be, a party of a lifetime.
Good. Looking
such
forward
a good
to
party that I've even cracked out the kilt.
Really?
I'm wearing the skirt. The skirt's going.
Right. So we've talked about the book. We've talked about the celebrations. And we're celebrating something else. Or maybe perhaps two things. What would those be?
Yes. So it may come as a huge shock and surprise to people that we are commemorating 175th anniversary with a limited edition watch made in 175 pieces.
That sounds to me like a proper limited edition number. What do you think?
It does. Yes.
Could we add like some zeros to the end or some ones in front just, you know, to get that real Swiss feel for a limited edition?
Get it up to those 10,000s and yeah. No, well, I mean, I think I've always been quite vocal about a few things to do with companies' heritage and also about limited editions. One of the things to do with the heritage is Fears closed in 1976. So from 77 to 2015, those 39 years, Fears was dormant. It was closed. And that's in the book. That's been on our website since day one because I didn't want to gloss over it. The easiest thing to do would have been to gloss over it and also just stick 1846 on the dial and just recreate a vintage watch. And in 2016, I would have been set. But I was like, no, we're going to do it differently. And that means that up until now, I've resisted doing basically a watch that is more vintage in style because we want to spend those first 5 years getting to a point where we're established doing our own thing. And yeah. Now going, right, if we were to do something vintage style, how would we do it? What's the doing it the 110% way as opposed to the half-hearted way? And what that is taking a watch from the archive, recreating it, doing a proportional recreation, using a new old stock movement from the same period as the original.
Where did you find old stock movements? And who made them? Are they Fears branded? Are they from, what was it, Rolex? When they first started, they just got movements from other places. Was it similar with you guys or did you make your own?
So to an extent, yes. So some of Fears watches used their own movements. Other ones would use good, solid Swiss movements. Now, one of the movements we're using started off life called the Zentra 185. No one's heard of Zentra, but the company that bought them out eventually became known as ETA.
Oh.
Which a few people might have heard of.
Reasonably well known.
So it became known as the ETA 717 by the late 40s, but the Zentra 185 started life back in 1935. We're talking about something nearly 90 years old. Now, where do you find them? These are not things that are openly for sale. You don't find someone on eBay. Someone might sell one, but it won't be new old stock. It will be very worn old stock. I decided that I wanted to create this watch that Fears had made in 1930s. And the watch is a specific shape. And because of that shape, it means you need a movement that is a specific shape. And you don't get modern versions, or certainly not modern versions that are easy to purchase unless you're owned by a big group. So this started my search of going, well, what if we were to try and find a movement that would work? And this is the crazy thing about the watch industry. You speak to one watch company CEO about this and just float it as a funny question. I don't suppose you know anyone who has these.
Yeah.
Within a few days, it turned out there was this chap, Jerry, somewhere in the Midlands, who had a box of these things. And so suddenly you find yourself put in contact with this random chap who doesn't own a watch company. He's not a watchmaker, but somehow he's got components to make around 60 of these movements. And when I say nuance, these aren't assembled movements that have never been used and we've stripped them or rebuilt them. This is literally lots and lots of little boxes of all the components, individual, most of them soaked in 90-year-old oil. And you're suddenly looking at this going, are there even the right amount of parts? And we realized we had everything bar one box, which was missing, which had a certain type of screw. And of course, being the 1930s, it wasn't a standardized screw that we can just buy a new one
off the B&Q.
Exactly. So we had to make new screws for that. And we realized we were going to, we knew from the start we'd fit a modern mainspring.
Yes.
And because the parts had never been used, we could afford to fit a modern mainspring because you can afford to have that high torque.
Yeah.
So this is a worry. If you've got a really, really old watch movement, you have to be careful about putting a mainspring that's too powerful, because the torque could cause damage to the parts because they've been running for 90 odd years. They'll be worn out. Whereas with these parts, these are fresh. But then we realize the next thing, a watch movement like this, which was, you know, this was a relatively sort of common, I wouldn't say mass produced, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't an ultra rare horology movement.
Yeah, it was a workhorse of its days.
It was a workhorse of its days. But unlike a movement, say, from the 60s or the 70s, every single part has to be finished to go with the next part.
Yeah, so it wasn't produced to the kind of tolerances we would do nowadays. It was a handmade parts, and you would have to, a bit like engines of its days in cars, it was you matched parts to parts. You couldn't just bosh them in and it worked. Yeah, it was a case of tailoring it to work.
To the point that we're, you know, having to turn every screw hole to make sure that everything will fit together. And then, the worst part. So after each movement, you know, is taking hours and hours and hours to assemble, just to do the first assembly. And then we had the fun thing and realizing that the balance, you'd put a balance in and you go, hang on, it's meant to be beating at 18,000 beats. And suddenly it's beating at, say, 17,000. So you take that balance out, put another one in and go, oh, well, this one's beating at 18,200. Well, that's a better place to start with. Now we can start bringing it down to 18. And so it ended up being a kind of matching things to work out where is it happiest. Once you get it to that point, make sure the balance is poised, regular, then strip it all down, completely clean everything. Because at this point you have been, you know, literally getting bits to kind of fit together, strip everything down, clean it, rebuild it, oil it. By the time the movement has gone into the final watch, I think it's been built and stripped about 3 times, because this is a movement from the 30s. This is not like modern movement technology. But what you end up with is something that is, when you feel the wind and you also hear the tick, it's beautiful. It's really got a very different feel.
This is truly something that's handmade.
You
know,
this is
it's taking the it's taking somebody's true craft, and you know, it's not like a technician that's just putting things together. This is, you know, watchmaking craft of actually having to match A with B with C to make sure that it works properly, and you know, the skill of the watchmaker to put everything together in a way that
to put life into the machine.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's not just a pull out the packet, stick it on, tighten it up, bob, job done. This is more a put it together, sigh quite a lot, take it all apart, try it a different way. Oh, that's better.
You said about cars, and it reminded me of back in the day, seeing somebody grinding in valves by hand.
Yeah.
Or kind of stuff.
Doing the timing, you know, it's like it wasn't a plug in a computer, no. Bob's your uncle, it's done. It's a putting in the little feeler gauges and measuring
listening
your
to the sound
gaps
from the different banks, yeah, balancing the carbs.
Balancing everything up. Yeah. You know, absolutely. It's a whole different world.
A lost world. Yeah.
Sadly is, yeah.
So the movements that have gone in, how reliable are they? What sort of accuracy will you get with them?
So the movement from the 30s, we are currently looking at it, once the watch is fully assembled, the time testing, coming in with a variance of about 30 seconds a day.
Wow, that is amazing.
Which, yes, considering that when this watch was built, it would have been somewhere between 30 seconds and a minute a day. You know, these weren't chronometer movements. So getting it to that 30 seconds. The other interesting thing, I mentioned we've got 39 years where the company closed. And then I mentioned we have got a batch of up to 60 of these movements, but we've made 175 watches. So this is one watch, but it's two watches.
Okay.
Right. So there's 175 watches. On the case back, rather than being engraved with a limited edition number, let's be a bit more fierce about this. Let's do something a little different. And so I came up with a crazy idea. What if each watch is engraved with a unique year from 1846 to 2021? So each watch represents one of the years from the past.
Okay.
Then you go, well, hang on, we've got this small batch of movements. There's no way we're going to get, you know, another 100 or so. So what should we do? Well, those movements have been reserved for the 39 watches from 1977 to 2015. So that very rare movement, the sleeping years. I think that's a very, I like that, the sleeping years, the dormant years when Fears was closed, when there was no business activity at this address. And so those 39 years are we're marking by using the rarer movement with more of the hand working on the movement as a very subtle nod of saying, yeah, the company closed, but it came back to life. Now, the other 136 watches use a different movement from the 60s, which doesn't have a small seconds. And so it results in a two-hander rather than a three-hander. However, both watches share an almost identical case, almost identical dial, bar a small seconds.
Yep.
And so they feel as one collection, but with a sub-collection within it. These watches are the first of a new family for Fears, which we're calling very simply Archival. And then the watch's name is just Archival 1930, because it represents the watch that it's taken from. The watch itself today is 17.7% larger, but all the ratios are identical. So all the balance, the size, the thickness, everything is the same. It's just a little bit larger. And that's just to accommodate the movement we chose. That, I mean, on reflection, it makes sense because it makes it a slightly more modern wearable size. But the fact is, it's not because we're shoehorning in, you know, a modern movement. We're going, actually, no, we are using a movement from that period. It's just, it was a bigger version of what's in the original watch.
What is the difference between the movement from the 30s and the ones from the 60s?
So the movement from the 1960s used in the two-hander, so that movement is a round movement as opposed to being a shaped movement, and it runs, its architecture is much more contemporary.
It's not just a continuation 20, 30 years down the line of like an ETA from 30 years ago versus now. This is a completely different.
So it is an ETA. It's called the ETA 2360, which was introduced in the 1960s. And it's just one of those workhorse ETA movements, the ones that were, you know, manual wind. Both watches are manual wind, but this was very much a manual wind, but it was a smaller movement, so it could be used in different shapes and sizes of watches, and it just runs. And that we can get that one a bit tighter to around 20 seconds tolerance a day, but it doesn't have a seconds hand. So it's, you know, you're not necessarily going to, you know, be timing it in that regard. But what it means is you wind it up, you wear it every day, you might notice a minute during the week. You know,
you're unlikely to miss your train.
Exactly.
Unless you're me, because I'm always late. But aside from that, I think it's a great story. I'm also very impressed that, you know, Nick has kindly let us put this out slightly before the official announcement. And
we're
managed
good at convincing people to let us do that.
We're good at that. But you've managed to very articulately not actually give away the actual shape of these watches, which I'm pretty impressed by.
No, I know. I know. Before we even do that, I'll talk about the dial next.
I'll be more impressed if you can talk about the dial without discussing the shape, but we'll see where that goes.
Well, it's not just the new old stock movements. When we're recreating an original watch, you're saying, right, well, let's look at the case, how the case is made, because case architecture then and today are very different. A big thing is the tolerances, but it's also how you approach building the case. And because I was adamant we were going to do it in the original style, our usual case maker in Germany who makes our Brunswick cases said, absolutely not. That's just going to be so much more time consuming, labor intensive with the machines. Because we have modern ways of doing it, it'd be quicker to do it this way. And I was like, it's got to be the Fears way, or we're not doing that.
Especially for a heritage piece like this.
Exactly. And so we ended up going to a different case maker down the road in Fossheimer, who basically said, yes, we can do this. Like, we, you know, let's take this on. And he really sort of bought into the project. He was like, I really like what you're trying to do here. Because I explained about, I showed him the original watch and said, this is what we want to recreate.
And it was his grandfather that bombed your house as well.
Well, we have these wonderfully awkward moments where you have in your head playing Basil Fawlty, like, don't mention the war. Don't mention the war. But you are then talking to, you know, the great grandson of a casemaker in Germany. And you realize that actually both our families were running the businesses during the 40s when we were busy bombing them and they were busy bombing us. And mm-hmm. you actually feel closer because of it, because you realize there is, and I mentioned before, we always work with family run independent suppliers. And it's largely for that reason that our companies have gone through the same sort of history.
Yeah.
But when it came to the dial, so approached our dial maker who we've been working with for the last 4 years, one of the best dial makers in Germany. And I said, this is the dial I want to recreate. And they said, wonderful, great. And I said, but I want it to be exactly the same. And the dial has got this metallic border, and the metallic border isn't applied, and it's not a sandwich dial. It's all one level. And they said, I think we can do that, but it's not something we've done for a while. So they said, could you leave the original watch with us? I said, absolutely. The next thing I know, a week later, they say, right, we've worked out how the original dial was made. And I was like, is the watch okay? The watch is fine. I said, well, how have you found out? And they said, we dismantled the watch and we x-rayed the dial and we found out how the layers were done. And I just love that sort of archaeology approach to reverse engineering something from 1930. And they said, we've gone through our archive of dials we were making in the 30s and 40s. And we found that, yeah, this is how dials were made then. And basically, you take a dial blank in brass, you mirror polish it, plate it in gold, 18 karat yellow gold, and then you do a protection print of that border shape. And that's basically like liquid masking tape, effectively. It's putting on a protection. You then sandblast the dial, plate it in silver, give it a flash plating in gold, and you get this wonderful, smooth, sandblasted finish with a warm color that I've called vintage champagne, bit of a pun, but it's that sort of pale gold as opposed to bright gold. And then you remove the masking, basically the protection, and you've got the original bright gold border shining through. But actually, if you were to think about it, the polishing and the sandblasting are the same levels. You know, we're talking about people who are making cases, making dials. These are people who want to just make something that's going to be easy and make you happy. And with this, I turn up and I'm just, you know, a complete and utter pain by going, yeah, but I want it made in the original way. I want it done in the traditional proper way. But I think you end up with something where, yeah, you hold the original 1930s watch and the 2021 watch next to each other. You can see it, one is bigger than the other. But the modern watch captures the soul of the original watch, yeah, which I think is very, very difficult to do.
I agree. And I think the big thing for me is, yes, it is bigger, but in proportion, in a very sympathetic way. I know a lot of people get upset sometimes when there's a modern reinterpretation of a vintage piece or a reissue or whatever you want to call it. Oh, but they've made it bigger or they've done this. And I think that things also move forward. And I think it makes it, if you'd done it as the original, it would have been a very occasional wear for most people because it's just too small by modern tastes.
Oh, I've that original watch, I've worn that on a handful of occasions when I'm wearing a dinner suit. And until the insurance company told me to stop wearing the archive watches, I got a bit of a slap on the wrist for that because, you know, when I bought them for the archive years ago, they weren't that expensive and now they're worth a small fortune.
Yep.
But when you wear it, it is tiny. You can barely read it and it's lovely, but in that vintage way.
Right, okay. Time to let the cat out of the bag ever so slightly.
We can hear the cat meow.
Yeah, we can. The whiskers is at the ready. Tell us about the watch.
Well, what I can say, the watch is not the Brunswick case shape. So it's not our cushion case or even the round case of the Redcliffe from several years ago. What
I love say, a triangular watch.
Triangles, octagons. I'm all about Dairy-ly. The octagons. Dairy-ly.
Famous octagons, exactly. What I will say, though, is the following year after our watch came out in 1931, a very iconic watch of a similar case shape was launched.
All the clues are there, listeners. All the clues are there.
Would that be a watch that Rick doesn't believe the backstory about?
Do we think Rick doesn't believe the
something
backstory?
Something to do with horses and hitting small balls.
Sounds
We're not
like
talking
good,
about yours this
like
time.
Sounds like a good Friday night out, to be honest. I think we might be onto something there.
Yeah.
You know, and also, you know, if anybody was quick off the mark and owns a lovely book that we may or may not have been talking about, there could be clues in there as well.
Which page would clues be in?
I've no idea. Does anyone know what page? Oh, we're getting shrugs of it's in there.
You'll just have to
it's
read the full thing.
I think we've given enough clues through all of this that if you want to get ahead of the curve and get 24 hours, 48 hours ahead of everyone else.
Yeah.
I'm sure we can work it out.
But we would recommend you guys definitely check out our Instagram page on Friday, 8 a.m. UK time. Also, the Fears website at that time. Or sign up. You guys have got a mailing list, haven't you? So inboxes will be getting filled.
Filled 8 a.m. on Friday. So yeah, if you head to the website, sign up to the newsletter. Yeah.
Told you Fridays were good.
Somebody's going to have that Friday feeling. I'm not going to give the game away too much more because we already have, but I would say there was a couple of watches at the start of the year that I was eyeballing, including a Concord and a Patek Gondola, I think it was called. So, yes, I'm looking at this on the table here and wondering how many pennies it's actually going to cost to get that on my wrist. How many pennies would it cost?
So, for the two-hander piece, it's £3,500, including UK VAT. And then for the freehander with the 1930s movement, it's £3,950.
No, that is not much of a difference.
It's very difficult to justify the full extent of all the extra hours, but I wanted it to be that people buy the watch they want rather than feeling they can only afford this one versus this one. Because each watch is engraved with a unique year, it may be a huge shock, but we are anticipating a few people requesting certain years. So we wanted to make sure we kept it sort of as one collection of 175 pieces.
David creeps quietly into the background, not having ever asked those questions.
Right. Well, I think we've given far too much information away already, so I might have to edit some of this out. But it is a pleasure always seeing you, especially in person.
I know. I was thinking back. This was almost exactly a year ago when I saw you both up here in Scotland. Yeah,
actually, in real life, IRL. But yeah, we're actually recording today, all sitting in the same room, which is a first in...
Do we have to do that social distancing stuff anymore? Is that passé?
I know, I like you sitting on my knee.
Stop bouncing me up and down. Fantastic to see you in real life, not on a video screen and not just on the end of the phone, and bringing up my present of a lovely book, which I will be thumbing through later on. It's too nice to put under the sugarly table leg. So yeah, we'll keep Ryan's book under there. And yeah, I would recommend anyone that's interested in watches, British watches, it doesn't have to be Fears, it could be anything, definitely check this out. And the price that you are selling this at, considering how much effort, energy has gone into, and years of work, not months, but years of work, it is definitely a cracker. So yeah, if people want to check out this watch, that watch, that watch, this book, find out more about the 175 and everything else, where should they go?
Best place to head is our website, fearswatches.com, and also our Instagram, @fearswatches. We keep it nice and simple.
Excellent. Well, there we have it. Check out our Instagram page. Check out the Fears Instagram page, obviously, and website. Sign up for their newsletter. Keep an eye on things, and I'm pretty sure you guys will be very happy when you see this watch when it is revealed to the world. So thanks, Nick. Thanks, Dave. We will catch you guys again soon.
Take care.
Thank you very much.